The Christian story always allows for suffering and death. When the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, it meant the Word would undergo death. Indeed, Jesus endured the full agony of death. It's part of the narrative, and we should be equipped to engage it.
That's Reverend Mary Annona Stoops, and today she brings you a message entitled Loving Life Without Rejecting Death. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4226 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. And today on Day One, we are honored to welcome the Reverend Mary Annona Stoops, a pastor, spiritual director, and end-of-life doula serving at North Decatur Presbyterian Church in Decatur, Georgia, where her ministry centers on congregational care and fellowship and adult spiritual formation. Across decades of service in both the United States and Australia, Mary Annona has guided communities with a deep attentiveness to the Spirit's work within and among us. She helped establish Columbia Theological Seminary's Certificate in Spiritual Direction program, and now she teaches in its Certificate in Older Adult Ministry. Mary Annona Stoops, oh, it is so great to have you on Day One. Welcome.
Good to be here. I've been looking forward to this, Katie.
Your ministry has some particular foci. You have focused for many years on congregational care and spiritual direction, but especially on the spiritual lives of older adults. How did your vocation begin to take that shape? What was the story there?
Well, I'll say I never saw it coming, Katie. But it really started 26 years ago with the birth of my daughter, Martha, who has Down syndrome. And when she was born, she, especially when she was young, she rarely met any of the real basic benchmarks for her development. Right. And that was hard. But what that got me doing was reflecting on how I thought about disability and what I thought about what it means to be human. And I came to see that much of my kind of where I was investing my sense of self and identity was in a person who kind of always met the benchmarks. And in fact, as the child of two academics, I, you know, just tried to exceed those benchmarks. And that was painful to see and to realize, but so necessary for me to see and realize. And because it was crucial for me to loving and seeing the fullness of who she is, but it also was important to love and see the fullness of who I am, that it's not about those things. And this is even though, of course, I preach the good news that God loves us unconditionally. but then I had this situation right in front of me that was just exposing things that, like I said, I wasn't even aware of the power of these things in my life until I had this discomfort and needed to kind of dig into it. And what I came to see through that or understand, and this is through the work of some really wonderful teachers and author. One is a palliative care physician named B.J. Miller, who talks about ability being on a continuum. And that we are all at some point in life disabled or vulnerable and in need of, we are dependent on others. It starts when we're infants.
Yep.
And then throughout the lifespan, there will be moments if we don't have a diagnosed disability, there will be moments and times of disability. It can be something as simple as getting the flu. It can be something as serious as a cancer diagnosis. And then when we come into our older years, that vulnerability really rises again, and our need for our interdependence really heightens. So that blew my mind. And, you know, I just got out of this notion that disability is abnormal and instead just put us all in this kind of big reality together.
Yeah.
And one other thing that came from that is that I came to see our humanity and our identity not being invested in our capabilities, like our achievements, but right. in our vulnerability. That's what binds us together, is our vulnerability. And one of my favorite writers says that we are at our best when we belong to each other. And that's the expression of the kingdom of God. We are at our best when we belong to each other. And that's what vulnerability facilitates, is that mutual belonging. So you can kind of see how this got me into the aging process and being curious about that. But there was one other really important thing, and that was my very own fun midlife crisis.
Oh, can't miss those.
So right in my 40s, and I had always thought that people who have midlife crises are people who've never grown up. You know, they
haven't done their work.
Right,
you got to really do your work.
And then I found myself right in the midst of one, and it was huge and hard. And I realized that it was at its core, it was an identity crisis. Yeah. And I wasn't hearing anything in the church that was helping me understand what was happening in my life. So I just went searching, and how do I integrate this spiritually? Because at the heart, it was a spiritual crisis. Yeah. And so then I read Richard Rohr's Falling Upward, and that just that was my text during those years, and my crisis lasted years. But when I was coming out of it, then I moved into a relationship with a congregation. I started working for the congregation I'm serving, and they were very willing to be on the journey with me in these conversations around aging and spirituality and dying and spirituality. So that's how I got here.
So help us with, like, what are some places that churches tend to get it wrong or sometimes just simply avoid when it comes to talking honestly about death?
You know, what I find is that they're just not talking about it. You know, maybe at sermons it's talked about and there's some theological work done, but they're not talking about the lived experience of what we do with this reality and of our mortality and the anxiety or the possibilities that it opens up for us. So my first thing is just to start talking about it. And up until the late 1800s and the 20th century, death and dying was really something people were kind of on their own with it, you know, before the rise of modern medicine. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you may have a doctor or some kind of healer who would come to you and try to offer some assistance, but basically you were kind of on your own. And things changed dramatically with the rise of modern medicine. And all of a sudden now, professionals are the ones who are taking responsibility and leading and guiding on care. And all of that is wonderful. But death in the process has become primarily a medical event.
Yeah.
And not a communal event, not a religious event, not a spiritual event, not something with the family. It is primarily a medical event and a physiological process. And I think this is partly why in the church we don't have much to say about it, you know,
because that's death. That's the end.
Right.
Period.
And in this model, the body is the battlefield. And death is the enemy, and you duke it out in your body, you know, with all these interventions. And that's where hope is invested too, then. Our hope is invested in the doctors and the medicine. So where does that leave the church? What is hope? What hope do we have to offer? You know, and often people think when there's no more treatments, there's no more hope.
Oh,
which
that's
I
so
think
true.
Increases yeah. our anxiety about death and dying because
yes.
we pulled the rug out of hope under hope. And so what else is there now? So beginning to examine this, talk about this, and ask this question, what is a larger understanding of hope?
You know,
and something large enough to sustain us no matter what the outcome is.
Yeah.
So, and what I find, and actually the research shows that these conversations are very, very enlivening.
Enlivening.
Yes.
What a paradox.
The
talking about death is enlivening.
It is enlivening. It is to put it out there and ask the questions and give people a chance to say, you know, however it is, what they have learned from their families about death, what are the messages from the church, from society, to just put those out there. And then again, what does our tradition have to say?
Yeah.
You know, how speak into these narratives.
Yep.
So I feel like that's one of the biggest surprises again and again, and one of the biggest delights is just how people come away so grateful to be able to spend some time talking about and examining their experience, their relationship to death.
Now, listen for God's word as we hear selected verses from the Gospel according to John, chapter 11, verses 1 through 45.
Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." And when Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world." When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, already there is a stench, because he has been dead 4 days." And Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God. So they took away the stone, and he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in cloth. And Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go.
Now, Reverend Mary Annona Stoops' sermon entitled Loving Life Without Rejecting Death.
A 2025 essay by Arthur C. Brooks sent me back to Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich, a story, Brooks notes, that few writers have matched in its ability to name the fear of dying. Ivan Illich has lived a respectable life, carefully plotting his career, providing well for his family, and achieving social success. But one day, Ivan has an accident that leaves him with a lingering pain. Days pass, and eventually illness overtakes Ivan. And when it becomes clear that he will not recover, something far more frightening sets in. Ivan realizes that everyone around him knows he is dying, and yet no one will name it. Conversations remain polite. Hope is performed. Ivan's doctors offer more treatments. The truth is avoided. What tormented Ivan most was not simply that he was dying, but that he was forced to face it alone. Tolstoy tells us that this denial was a poison to Ivan, even greater than the cause of his illness. This story remains unsettling because it points to something painfully familiar. We find it hard not only to grasp the idea of death, but to face its reality when it comes close. The fact that only one in three Americans have advanced directives for their end-of-life care perhaps highlights our tendency to avoid and feel uncomfortable with dying and death. The most common reasons given for not having done this simple paperwork were first simply not having gotten around to it, kind of putting it off, or feeling it's too uncomfortable to think about. In his book, Speaking of Dying, Fred Craddock argues that the church colludes with our culture's avoidance of death and challenges pastors to speak meaningfully into this ordinary aspect of life that troubles us so. Craddock and his co-authors note that the Christian story always allows for suffering and death. When the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, it meant the Word would undergo death. Indeed, Jesus endured the full agony of death. It's part of the narrative, and we should be equipped to engage it. This is why the story of Lazarus is so significant. It revolves around death, Lazarus's and Jesus's, and how we may relate to both. As the story opens, we learn that Lazarus is sick. His sisters send word to Jesus, Lord, the one whom you love is ill. Yet Jesus delays. Not because he does not care, we know that he loves them. Not because he lacks power, they know he has the power to save Lazarus. But because there is some truth about God's glory that cannot be revealed without passing through death. Lazarus dies. Now, Jesus tells the disciples, it is time to go to Bethany. Even before Jesus arrives, grief has settled in. The rituals have begun, the tomb is sealed, and decay has taken hold. Martha meets Jesus on the road, and she does not soften her words or hide her disappointment. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus says that Lazarus will rise again, Martha interprets this as something to look forward to in the future at the end times, but Jesus gently tells her, I am the resurrection and the life. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Jesus invites Martha to trust a deeper reality already at work, a life so fully rooted in God that even death cannot interrupt it. And then from her deep grief, Martha speaks one of the clearest confessions in the Gospel of John. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. If saying the right words were all that mattered, the story would end there. The glory would be revealed. But Jesus does not stop with Martha's confession. Jesus knows that good theology or words alone cannot fully meet death's demands. So Jesus goes on to meet Mary on the road, and when he does, there is no more talk of theology. She collapses in sorrow. She weeps, and the community weeps with her. The passage tells us that Jesus is deeply moved. He is not detached from what is unfolding. He does not remain strong for them. Jesus was greatly disturbed, says the text. Jesus loses his composure and weeps with them. And it's not because Jesus doubts God or has forgotten what is possible, but because love does not stand apart from suffering or observe grief and death from a distance, but enters fully into them with us. Finally, Jesus arrives with them at the tomb. And when they get there, they hesitate. Jesus is cautioned against opening it. Lord, there is already a stench. Don't get any closer. But Jesus insists. The glory that Jesus has promised is yet to be fully revealed. The stone is rolled away, and Lazarus is called out. And he emerges alive, but still bound, wrapped in grave clothes. And again, the story does not end here. Jesus turns to Lazarus's community and says, "Unbind him and let him go." Jesus does not do this work alone. Transformative love now requires human hands. It requires all of them to come near to what death has touched. And this too is part of the glory Christ reveals and that we are invited to share. It is not ours to defeat or deny death, but to participate in a love that abides in and through it, through our presence, loosening what death has bound where we can for one another. Because resurrection is not only something God does to us, but something love does among us. When Tolstoy tells the end of Ivan Illich's story, the terror does not ease because Ivan is cured. He is not. His body continues to weaken. Death continues its work. What changes is not the outcome, but the presence. As Ivan becomes more helpless, one person stays close. It's his servant, Gerasim. Gerasim does not avert his eyes. He does not soften the truth. He also doesn't rush Ivan toward false hope or pretend this is anything other than what it is. Gerasim enters the truth of what is happening when others cannot. He holds Ivan's legs to ease his pain and sits with him through the night. Tolstoy tells us that this simple, unguarded presence brings Ivan more relief than any medicine. Gerasim does not save Ivan from death. He saves him from dying alone. And this changes everything for Ivan. As death approaches, it loses its sting. Tolstoy writes, "Ivan searched for his accustomed fear of death and could not find it." Oh, bliss are Ivan's dying words. Gerasim is an icon for our vocation. doing exactly what Jesus asks of the community at the tomb, unbind him and let him go. The poet laureate of Colorado, Andrea Gibson, died this past July at the age of 49 of ovarian cancer. Weeks before she died, she wrote this blog post. I'm rarely inspired to write while hurting. I write from the soft or not so soft landing of the lesson learned. I write when I've had enough time and distance to say, thank goodness that happened. But today, so as never to clip the wingspan of truth, I am writing to you from the heart of the wound, from the bullseye of ache. I am writing in pain, friends, knowing many, if not most of you, are in some kind of pain as well. A few weeks ago, my parents visited. I wanted to hide my hurting from their hearts and tuck it away so they wouldn't have to carry it too, pretend I was fine. But we are always better with the truth, my father had told me on the phone before the trip. So I fell into my mother's arms, sobbing the way I did as a child when I fell off my bike. Because I didn't pretend to be okay, something new rooted between my parents and I, an even deeper tenderness, a kind of closeness that grows when no one is trying to spare anyone else from what is hard to hear. People think that the worst thing that can happen is the truth. The truth is not the worst thing that can happen. Abiding with one another in such vulnerable communion. This is our calling. And when we take it up in our living and in our dying, Christ is present with us. The gates of heaven open, and the glory of God is revealed.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Mary Annona Stoops. For a free transcript of her sermon, Loving Life Without Rejecting Death, you can visit us online at dayone.org. I hope you heard that bit in her sermon. I just loved it. Unbind him and let him go. In Lent, maybe resurrection practice looks like using our own hands for mercy, loosening where grief and fear have tightened. So let's ask ourselves, how might God be inviting us to be unbound? And how might you or I be called to help unbind someone else? We'd love to connect with you directly and hear how this message met you today. Leave us a voicemail anytime at our Atlanta phone number, 404-490-3354. It goes straight to us. Or email me directly at host@dayone.org. And to our radio listeners, thank you for tuning in. You've heard the full sermon, but you're only getting part of the story. On the Day One Weekly podcast, we sit down with the preacher and have an extended conversation that we can't fit on the radio broadcast. Why this biblical text matters right now, how the sermon came together, where they're sensing God at work in the world today. Subscribe to the Day One Weekly podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or at dayone.org, or on our YouTube channel. For 81 years, Day One has shared messages of hope and unity. This ministry exists because of listeners like you. If Day One has been meaningful in your life, we invite you to join us and support this work at dayone.org/donate, or by mailing your contribution to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia, 30319. Thank you. Thank you for helping us to continue to share hope with a world that needs it. Next week on Day One, as we step into the story of Palm Sunday, the Reverend Enid Almanzar from the National Latino Evangelical Coalition helps us look again at that familiar scene, this time through the quiet faith of a humble donkey. Her sermon, Carriers of Destiny, rooted in Matthew 21, shows us how Jesus chooses what seems small, even forgotten, to carry the weight of his glory. Reverend Almanzar invites us to think about the ways we too might feel a little bit like that donkey, tied up, stuck, tired, overlooked, and how Christ still speaks release and purpose into these places in our lives. She reminds us that in God's kingdom, freedom always carries love somewhere new. It's a message about surrender, steadiness, and the strange beauty of being chosen for holy work, even when we feel donkey ordinary. That's Reverend Enid Almanzar, next week on Day One. Mary, there are so many reasons I love this sermon. I mean, it makes me think about the resurrection differently. So as we journey towards Easter, the ultimate celebration of triumph over death, literally those are the words used so often. How can we just shift that a little bit?
I tend to approach, rather than victory over death or triumph over death, it is an abiding in and through death. It is death is reconstituted by love.
Death reconstituted by love. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's transfigured by love. Because the reality is that people still die. We still die, you know?
And turns out God's with us through it.
Right, right. And it turns out that there is more.
Yeah.
There is more. And it's that more that I want people to look for, because that's where the good news is when you can, when you are sitting with the reality of a painful death. And you're like, not defeated. So what can we be looking for? What can we be opening ourselves to, you know, even as we bear the pain?
Yeah.
Even as we bear the pain, that the pain is not this, the Christian message is not going to magically protect us from the pain. But it can sustain us in the pain.
And give us meaning. Really give us some meaning and some tools and something besides death is failure and absence and pain. And it's not. Right. That's what's really paradigm shifting, or all the terms. Like it really changes the story.
Right. And it also has the possibility of being part of our journey of transformation into the likeness of Christ. You know, Christ, Jesus uses death as, he says, unless a grain falls to the ground and dies, it remains just that one grain. And then, you know, if you don't lose, those who lose, save their lives will lose them, and those who lose their lives will save them. He's offering us this image of death as an emblem or a portal to understanding our own process of transformation. Yeah. You know, so resurrection has the power to do that same work with us and through us and in us.
Mary, what practices help you remain grounded and open when you're holding other people's grief and you might be having your own? You might be, in fact, most of the time we are.
Yeah, what I have really come to do is allow my grief when it comes. And not only that, to trust my grief when it comes. And this is this is the first time.
It's so hard.
It is so hard. And as you said, sometimes the grief comes and it's uncomfortable and the timing's not good.
Inconvenient.
A wave will come and I'm out in public and the next thing you know, I'm crying. But what I found is when I can stay with my grief and ride the wave of it, there's always something on the other side waiting for
me. Yeah.
And I can't always allow my grief to kind of come when it comes. There are times when I can't. But whenever I can, I do. I let it come and I receive it with trust. So that's my practice right now. That's about all it amounts to.
And because if you don't attend to it, that's so grief. It'll just keep coming back.
It'll just keep coming back. I feel like I have seen situations where unprocessed grief has just led to so much pain down the road. Yeah. And not just for the person who didn't process it, but for others as well. And so, for myself and for the people I love and really for this world, I want to process my grief.
Yes. I've heard you talk about, what is it, the U-shaped curve of happiness?
Yeah, the U-shaped curve of happiness.
Yeah, so, what's that?
Yeah, so there's been lots of studies trying to measure contentment and happiness across generations. And consistently, the data comes out in this U-curve that starts up high, goes down, and then goes up really high at the end, according to decades. And what the data finds is that people who are 80 and above are the happiest, report to be the happiest people. And that's like such a surprise, even happier than the 20-year-olds who are happy, but not as happy as the, 80-plus-year-olds.
The deep happy.
The deep happy. And so there was a researcher at Stanford, Laura Carstensen, who was curious about what is behind this. You know, is it simply that wisdom allows us to process life differently as we age, or get better at letting go of things? You know, she wanted to get behind that data and not just guess at it. And so she did further studies with people of all decades who are facing end of life.
Wow.
And they report the same happiness that the 80-plus-year-olds do.
Oh, fascinating.
On a day-to-day touch-in. You know, when they just, because that's how they pinged this study, they would just randomly send them a message saying, 1 to 5, rate your happiness. You know? And so what she discovered is that it's time.
Yeah.
And the nearness, perceived nearness of death that really supports this report of happiness in the moment, of ability to be accepting and present in the joy of the moment.
Well, that circles right back to the way, as you shepherded us in the sermon through the Lazarus story, it lingers with grief before it moves toward life. And so us being so tempted to rush past grief, am I hearing correctly that science says that we actually paradoxically miss out on some contentment and happiness if we rush through or numb ourselves past the grief.
Yeah, or if we don't sit with the reality of death, we also lose it, that clarifying alchemy that comes when we truly embrace or accept that this is a finite thing here. You know, this isn't going to last forever. It actually helps clarify how we do want to spend our time, who we want to spend our time with.
So sitting with the reality of death, different than grieving. I just realized I conflated two things.
Yeah.
Sitting with the reality of death helps clarify.
Yeah, but it does. But the reality of grief too, when we try to speed past it, we don't give ourselves the opportunity to do the meaning making.
Yep.
That is an essential part of grief and grieving. And that's what's going on with when you process the reality of death, you're doing meaning making. Yeah. You know, you're reframing your life and your values and your priorities. And this isn't new. I mean, this Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying, was this book that the church had that came out of the plague when there weren't priests available to come to the people. So many were dying and there weren't enough priests to attend to death and dying. Yeah. And so they had this book called the Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying. And it was this document largely done in pictures because people weren't necessarily literate to help them through the dying process. And it was prayers and it was rituals. You know, it was all this support to wrap their the sacred around this process.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so that's what there is that potential for us to do that when we are willing to stay with it, whether it's grief or whether it's actual dying or death. It's the abiding, which is what I think Jesus does, you know, in his way, on his way to the tomb, is this abiding
with
it, staying with it.
Mary, switching to another, well, theological cluster, because the scripture passage in your sermon had so much going on. The command to unbind him that Jesus makes, unbind him, that shifts the work to the community. The community unbinds. Where do you see, if we can call that resurrection work, because that seems really generative, where can we find that kind of resurrection work needed in ordinary life?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think listening to the stories of older adults, especially those who are confined to their homes or bed, being willing to come near and ask them to tell their story.
And be genuinely curious.
Be genuinely curious.
Yeah.
I think visiting someone in an immigration detention center is this work of unbinding.
Wow.
I think asking a teenager what it's like to grow up right now can be part of our task of unbinding, drawing near. And then, of course, exploring your own relationship to death. I think that is really crucial. I think we all will be surprised to find the ways that we are living somehow in death's shadow in some way, whether through a family experience, whether through some loss we've faced in the past. I don't know, but to be able to examine our relationship with death and then imagine the kind of relationship or how we want to live now, knowing we will die.
Yes.
You know? And so those, you know, questions like asking to just think about your ancestors and talk about those who've gone before you and what have been their gifts to you. That's such an enlivening conversation. You know, and then it helps us begin to think about our own legacy and who we want to be to the people that we love or to this world. And if time was limited, what do you want to say to them? You know, well, then why wait? You know, say it now. Those kinds of conversations are unbinding. They unbind us.
Okay, Mary, thinking especially about listeners who are walking alongside someone who is dying or listeners who are carrying grief. Gosh, isn't that most of us on some level? What do you most hope this sermon gives them permission to do?
So often I'm with someone and I hear, they'll start to cry and then they start to apologize for crying. And I'm like, no, just the tears are just what is necessary. And so to begin to see that grief, that the and it's all of its expression, any struggle along the way of dying or grief, there's nothing to apologize for. And so to allow it to be messy, because it is messy, and that these are processes we want to think we can control, because that's so important in our culture and how we, you know, have fashioned our identity as a person who's kind of got it together and in control, just to unbind ourselves from that or allow ourselves the bindings to fall away when it comes to that. Because then you can begin to trust that God's still got this, you know? It's all okay. And there's always more. There's always more than the grief of the moment.
Yes. As we move toward Holy Week, what do you think it can mean to practice resurrection now?
To practice resurrection now, go through Holy Week.
Yes.
So often.
Don't skip to it.
We go to Palm Sunday, and then we come back again at Easter, and we kind of didn't follow Jesus through those really excruciating days. Very excruciating days. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's resurrection arises out of the fullness of what Jesus experienced there. And that the Paschal mystery, which is the mystery of his dying and coming to life again, that's not just something for Jesus. That's a template for us as well. And it's a journey that we can undertake in our lives and with our grief and with our losses, that Paschal mystery. And so to go through it is the first practice. Don't shortchange ourselves, you know, by jumping right to resurrection. But I want to tell a story. I was, after my father died, I was flying back. My parents are in Houston and I'm in Atlanta, and I was flying back. And, you know, when I was in it was a very intense, though he'd been sick, it was still unexpected because we did not think it would come as quickly as it did, and we did not think a procedure that he was having would actually hasten death, and it did. So we were caught in dealing with a lot of intensity of hospitalizations and so forth, and there wasn't the time to be with my grief as much as I would have liked. And then there's the dying, and then there's all those things that have to be done. So I'm on the airport in the airplane, sitting in my seat. And I just lose it. I just start weeping, ugly crying. And fortunately, I'm in an aisle seat, and there's no one in the middle seat next to me. So at least there wasn't someone on either side having to deal with me. And then, but after 5 minutes or so, it was clear I'm not stopping, you know. The woman in the window seat said to me, you know, "Are you okay? Is there anything I can do?" And I told her, I just said, "My father's just died, and it's been so intense and hard, and it's just catching up with me." And she said, "You know, my husband is living with dementia, and he's in a memory care facility, and we've just, she started to tell me his story of just in as recently as 2020, he was still working. He was still living a very vigorous life. And she pulled out a picture and showed me him now in this center, and he was so diminished." And the next thing you know, we're like both crying. We're both sitting in his air, just both weeping and weeping. And then after a while, we're laughing at ourselves because, you know, the spectacle we're making on this airplane. And, you know, that moment of two people meeting each other in their vulnerability, in their grief. I mean, it was a moment. I mean, my grief in that moment was transfigured. You know, it really, to not be sitting there so alone with it.
Yeah.
And I hope, I know the same gift was given to her as she carries this hard reality of her husband and what he's going through. And that, you know, that's that sustenance that's promised to us through the being willing to belong to each other, even to a stranger on an airplane, you know, being willing to allow our vulnerability to open us up to this deep belonging that is always there, but we don't encounter most of the time when we're moving through the world.
But it is always there for us.
It's always there, always. And that's the kingdom, you know, that's the work of resurrection, is making that belonging, making that interconnected web of love visible to us.
Mary Annona, you have brought us a beautiful sermon. I thank God for you and your ministry and all that you've brought us today. Thank you so much for being on Day One.
Thank you for asking, Katie. It really was. it was a joy always to be with you and to sit with this text and kind of talk about what I love doing. So thank you.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays, and we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Kime. May the grace of God be with you on Day One and every day yet to come.